Finance Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. Good morning, everybody. And before we get started, I wanted to mention that after consultation with the vice chairs, we have decided that we're going to start at 8:30 instead of 8 o'clock for a while until we find that floor sessions are going to impinge on the other end. But it seems like right now we probably can make that work. So we're reposting our Friday morning agenda and having that start at 8:30 and then on Monday also. So, okay. Well, we are very pleased this morning to have some invited testimony from the Oregon Law Commission, and there have been certainly some very exciting doings that are going to be coming before us as we move forward in our work with recommendations from the Law Commission. But this morning, we mainly wanted to just get an overview of what the Law Commission had been working on this interim, and I know Representative Berger has been involved in at least part of that work, so we'll look forward to hearing from you. We have Wendy Johnson, the Deputy Director, as well as Attorney General Hardy Myers, and Samuel Sears is here. Would you all like to come up together? Would you? Whatever your pleasure is. Yeah, that's great.
Madam Chair, I was just going to make some brief remarks.
That would be great. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity to open this review by the committee of the work of the Oregon Law Commission on governmental ethics. The study that the Law Commission undertook was a mandate of the 2005 regular legislative session, and it was backed by an appropriation of about $250,000 to the Commission to provide the additional staff support that would be needed for an undertaking of that magnitude, along with the other ongoing projects that the Commission had in the queue, so to speak. And the study was undertaken, as are most Law Commission studies, by the formation of a work group, which was composed of various members of the community, including Representative Berger, whose participation I'd like again to acknowledge and extend thanks for, very valuable participation, as well as an advisory group of individuals who were not technically voting members of the work group, but who were invited to participate in the ongoing deliberations. We divided the study into essentially the substantive policy area on the one hand, and on the other hand, the area of administration of the ethics laws, remedies, the more or less the process, procedural components of the total law. I was chair of the overall project, and I chaired the substantive policy work group, and Law Commissioner Greg Mao, a member of the Stoll Reeves Law Firm in Portland, chaired the process and administration subgroup. And then at the end of the roughly year or so period of separate work, the recommendations of the two subgroups came together and were acted on by the full work group and forwarded to the Law Commission for its culminating consideration in December. I would only add at this point, Madam Chair and members, that as a mandate of the Legislative Assembly, of course, the undertaking was pursued with utmost seriousness on the part of the Law Commission. That's the highest, so to say, origin of any work the Law Commission can have, a directive from the Assembly itself, as opposed to a request from some other source. And it's my sincere hope that overall, the committee and the assembly will find the resulting recommendations of the commission beneficial to your efforts to improve, update, and improve the government ethics laws of Oregon. Putting aside the process component, I have come to think of the ethics laws really as a statement of expectations, if you will, about conduct in public authority. Much of that law is framed as prohibitions, but I would really rather think of them as expectations for conduct, which are adopted to safeguard the public's confidence, if you will, that public authority is being exercised in a way that is appropriately non-self-dealing, self-serving, self-benefiting. And as I say, I hope very sincerely that the resulting recommendations will be of benefit to you as you work toward your final decisions with respect to changes and improvements in Oregon ethics law. Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to open the comments today.
Thanks for being here. Wendy?
For the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission, and I'd like to go on record of thanking the Attorney General for his leadership throughout this entire project. We started in November of 2005, right after session, and have been meeting monthly, twice monthly, three times a month with the Attorney General in his office many weeks, weekly. I had the privilege of serving as a law clerk for the Attorney General when I was in law school, and I think I've seen the Attorney General more this year as staff of the Law Commission. Truly has dedicated a great deal of time and energy to just reforming Oregon's ethics laws. I'd like to bring up Sam Sears with me at this time also. He serves as staff attorney to the Oregon Law Commission. The Attorney General has explained to you that the Oregon Law Commission has been working on this ethics project and has reforms that will be coming before this committee, but I wanted to back up one more step because I think this committee is new to the legislature, and many of the members on this committee are probably still wondering what is the Law Commission, because generally the Law Commission has been before the Judiciary Committee as routine, and I'm not recognizing too many Judiciary Committee folks here. So if this committee is willing, I'd like to sort of explain the Law Commission.
Please.
The Law Commission itself was created pretty recently, also in 1997, by this assembly, and then appropriations first began in 2000. And the commission is funded by a private-public relationship. It's rather unique. Part of the funding is paid for by the state, but the other half or more is matched by Willamette University. It's housed with the law school at Willamette University. We have a dean who cares a lot about law reform and saw the need and was willing to, had worked in Louisiana with a similar law commission and saw the need to bring law reform to the state, bridging the academic community as with the legislature, frankly, and assisting that area of what you hear in law school is what's broken in each state and how some states have different laws, and but there's really not an opportunity to actually engage in fixing those. And so having a law commission housed at a university allows that to happen. It also allows our students to get involved in law reform. So there's not a direct benefit to the university, but it is something to bring to a law and government program at the law school, and it helps save taxpayer dollars by sharing some of that burden. So that's where we're housed, just across the street at Willamette University. It's a unique commission in that it's composed of 13 members representing all three branches of government, in addition to the academic community. So I want to go through those 13 members. It's an amazing list of folks who all have very busy lives but have volunteered to work with the Law Commission as a commissioner. First off, two members are appointed by the Senate President. So present commissioners appointed by the Senate President are Senator Kate Brown and Davis Wright Tremaine partner John DiLorenzo. The House Speaker also has two appointments. Those two are our current chair of the Law Commission, Lane Cheddarly, Director of Land Conservation and Development. The other House appointment is one of your former colleagues, former Representative Robert Ackerman from Eugene. In addition to the House and Senate appointments, there are two ex officio members, the Attorney General and the Chief Justice. So Attorney General Myers serves as commissioner, as well as Chief Justice Paul Dominguez. Then the governor has an appointee, and that present member is former Justice Hans Lindy, now professor at Willamette University. As you can tell, it's the legal scholars of the state. Moving on, the commission also has three members that are appointed by the Oregon State Bar. The Oregon State Bar has the highest governing authority is what's called the Board of Governors, and the Board of Governors appointed three members. The first is Sandra Hensberger. She's now the executive director for the Campaign for Equal Justice. That's the organization that helps to pay for legal aid and does fundraising and such. Formerly, she had been a professor at Lewis and Clark in the area of family law. Next, we have Greg Mao, who's a partner at Stoll Reeves, has a litigation practice and eminent domain practice. Greg Mao served as sub-work group chair of this project, so was involved with monthly meetings as well and provided great leadership to the project. The third spot from the Oregon State Bar is open right now. Justice Martha Walters had been a commissioner when she was in private practice in Eugene, but when she was appointed to the bench, she resigned that post since it's more of a bar appointment. So we're waiting for a replacement there. And finally, each of the three Oregon law schools have a member on the commission. The dean can be a member or the dean can appoint someone else. At Willamette University, Dean Simeon Simeonides is the commissioner. From Lewis and Clark Law School, Professor Bernie Vail, family law professor. And from the University of Oregon, Professor Don Vetri, a torts professor. So that's our 13-member commission. The legislature, when it created this body in 1997, the sole charge was to recommend law reform. And so we're not a super legislature or anything. The only thing we can really do is recommend to this body law reform. We could also recommend administrative rule changes or other types of reform, but our primary mission since the creation has been law reform. And so in 2001, the first session, there were, I think, three or four bills, and then each session we've been gradually doing more and more work. I think that the increase in the number of our bills, each recommended bills each session, and the complexity of our bills is a reflection of how the commission itself has matured, but also a reflection of the fact that this body has come to rely on outside sources to do law reform as it struggles with the budget each session more and more and has less time to do traditional law reform. I think many have reflected the fact that there are fewer and fewer lawyers in the assembly as well to handle some of the complex areas of private law. And also our state has worked in some of its public law areas. They're overlapping more and more, and so the Law Commission has been there to help fix an area of law when it involves the courts, it involves private lawyers, it involves an agency or something. There's not one entity to come forward with a bill, that there has to be somebody who can coalesce the certified experts, if you will, in an area and help. So ethics is one of those types where it's involved the private community as well as the state agency and all public officials who are involved. And so the Law Commission has been able to help in that area. You'll be seeing many other bills this session. I'd highlight one, for example, is a government bonding project where the state treasurer and the municipal debt advisory committee, those who do bonding for local governments, came to the commission and said, we have three chapters of bond law that are confusing and outdated, and none of us can do it by ourselves. We need a group to help us work through it. And so we'll be presenting a bill that right now is over 200 pages of law that helps clean up the process for everyone to make bond laws clear. That's a steep learning curve, let me tell you, to really understand bond law, but we've been able to do that. I don't think it's coming to your committee. I just want to emphasize that our commissioners are very busy professionals, but they truly are dedicated to law reform and meet regularly and are dedicated. And all of our commission projects are chaired by a sitting commissioner. And so the Attorney General did chair this project, as well as Greg Mao served as a sub-work group chair. So I think that's important to keep in mind. We do have a small staff that's located at Willamette University. I serve as deputy director. David Kanegi serves as executive director. He's also associate dean at the law school. Sam Sears serves as staff attorney to the Law Commission. And then we have some part-time folks. One, a legal assistant who helps with reception work as well, Lisa Ehlers. And then Professor Jerry Watson has served part-time as reporter for this project. So that's our staff. In choosing projects, we have a statute that lists some of the sources of projects requests. Some have come from this body, some have come from judges, some have come from the private attorneys, some have come from agencies. And, of course, we give the highest respect to those that come from this assembly, but we have to also juggle our workload and our resources. As the Attorney General mentioned, this project came to the Oregon Law Commission at a request from two sources. In 2003, a veto letter of an ethics bill, the Governor Kulongoski, requested the Law Commission look at government ethics laws. That obviously happened at the end of the 2003 session, so there wasn't any time for an appropriation or a whole lot of detail. It came in a letter. The Law Commission was receptive to the request at the time, but we already had a full slate and recognized that it would take a great deal of time time to do. Willamette University did agree to conduct a study to sort of do some background research, and Professor Watson did that even without any additional funding in the 2003-2004 timeframe. Then at the close of the 2005 session, this assembly in Senate Bill 420 appropriated money and did a request. The request had changed a bit, actually, from the governor's request, which was focused generally on ethics and the agency, to include also some campaign finance review and also more of a top to what is the agency doing and how is it functioning and looking more at funding issues. So the request had changed a bit from 2003 to 2005. As soon as that request passed, the Law Commission agreed to take on the project, and as the Attorney General explained, he agreed to chair the project, and we began working. You have a handout that sort of outlines the same process that I just explained, that's dated January 17th from Lisa Ehlers, our legal assistant, sort of lays out how we got this project. And then on the second page, it lists who participated on the project, both the members and advisors. The Law Commission is supposed to be a nonpartisan, disinterested law reform organization. And so we ask both our commissioners and those who serve on our work groups to check their clients at the door and work on law reform that will be the best for this state and not for their clients. And so those members listed agreed to not represent their clients, but to bring their expertise and experiences to the process. We also knew there were a number of people who are very passionate about this topic and have a lot of expertise, and we wanted to make sure they were included in it so that the work group could make reasoned decisions that reflected reality as well. And so we had a great group of advisors as well who participated very regularly. So that's why there's the distinction here. We have the voting members, and then we have the advisors who were involved. And all of them just spent an enormous amount of time in this last year coming up with the recommendations that were ultimately approved by the Law Commission and that will be forwarded on to this body. There were a number of issues that we tackled. Obviously, in recent months, the press has taken on the topic of ethics a great deal, and this body is talking about ethics a great deal. But I want to step back and remind this committee that when the Law Commission started the project, there were a couple of, quote, sexy issues. Spouse travel, I think, was one, and just the confusion in the ethics area. But when the Law Commission was asked to do this project, it was to do a comprehensive review, and that by that I mean an entire review of the whole chapter of government ethics, which is primarily in Chapter 244, and there are also some provisions in Chapter 171. Those are the provisions that apply to lobbyists. So we literally started from the not literally at the beginning, but we went through nearly every provision in the chapter, but certainly every topic in the chapter, checking to see if it was readable, if the standard was right, if it worked in practice, if it was inclusive enough or it needed to be broader. Our topics are not, some of them aren't as perhaps as interesting as others, but you have a list of the general topics that we did cover this interim. When you're asked to do a comprehensive review, you have to deal with a lot of details that aren't so exciting, but if you don't take the time while we're doing a comprehensive overhaul, they will never get fixed. And we've learned that many provisions were obsolete or didn't really extend to the groups of people that they should or just weren't explained very well. So today, I understand you're looking for just sort of a background explanation. You have the list of topics there, and I assume each of these topics will be coming into this committee as the bills actually get here. We had 15 legislative concepts that were approved by the commission, working with leadership in both the Senate and the House with Senator Kate Brown and Representative Rosenbaum. We anticipate that 10 bills will actually be introduced and split between the House and the Senate for their chamber of origin. We're generally keeping those to topic bills. So, for example, you should see like a nepotism, subsequent employment bill, gift bill, if you will. So they will be kept as topics so that they're easier for people to grasp and for the public to participate as well. The legislature also requested that this committee take public testimony throughout its process, and we did do that. Obviously, that the spin changed because when it was time for public testimony, it was right about the time that the gift issues were coming up in the press. So we didn't get a lot of comment on conflict of interests or how the GSPC does its business and, you know, that type of issue anymore. It was pretty much focused on gifts. To that end, we understand that that's an important issue in the House, and this your chamber passed rules the first day regarding gifts, and those rules have caused some questions and some confusion, and so we have also provided you another, the second handout, with the great at the top that compares what the House rule gift rules are, if you will, what Senate Bill 10, which is a bill that started in the Senate on its first day of hearings, what present law is, and also what the Law Commission is recommending, sort of a visual play-by-play of how gifts would work. It's not an easy area, I'll just be honest. It takes a number of lawyers to decide on many occasions if something is a gift that's okay or that's not. And we'll look forward to working with you. Sam Sears prepared this chart, and if that's a topic you want to go into today, I think we're ready to do that as well, or just take questions.
Well, it's really helpful to have this matrix that shows what the law is right now and then your recommendations juxtaposed with the House rules. And also, I noticed that you've outlined the provisions of Senate Bill 10 there, too. So that's great. And maybe committee members will take a minute to look at that. Representative Berger, you have a question.
Yeah. I wonder, Sam or Wendy, if, thank you, Madam Chair, if you'd outline. Under the value limitation thing on the front of this, under the Oregon Law Commission recommendations, the $100 maximum per gift, there was also provisions for reporting within that recommendation that were a little different than what we've done, and I wonder if you'd go into that because it isn't on the face of this. It looks like business as usual, $100 maximum, but that is not really the substance of the recommendation.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, the third handout that you have before you is a PowerPoint presentation that captures basically a summary of all the recommendations the Commission is recommending. We're sort of relying on this until the bills actually come out. But if you take a look at page 13 of your handout, slides 25 and 26, we explain reporting requirements. Presently, as you should all know, as formerly been candidates and now as members of this body, you're required to fill out an SEI, a Statement of Economic Interest. That report is only once a year for public officials. The Law Commission work group looked at this issue of reporting a great deal, especially in light of recent press, but also in terms of practicality and bookkeeping. A once-a-year report isn't particularly helpful to remind people to keep all their receipts, to keep things in order. It's also a different reporting schedule than what the lobbyists have right now. Lobbyists have a twice-a-year report on the even years and three times a year on the odd years. That's confusing is when the public official has a once-a-year. And so the work group considered all of that information and also focused on what is it that the public wants to know more often, what is it that the public has a more of a right to know details, or what do they care about? Do they care about your property, or do they care about who's giving you money or gifts that has a legislative interest? And obviously the group decided that there are only a couple of things that are very important in terms of trying to decide if there's a problem with conflicts and such. And so they pulled out four income pieces, if you will, and said those things we should be getting four times a year. And so those are the big areas of the food, lodging, and travel that's related to an event, sources of income that are over $1,000 from somebody who has a legislative or administrative interest, honoraria, and gifts. Those four items would be reported four times a year, and lobbyists would be reporting those four things as well. So as Representative Berger suggested, the limits of the $100 per gift and the limit of $250 per year from the same source is similar to present practice, although present practice also allows $250 for entertainment. That has been deleted in the Law Commission's recommendations. So the total for per source has gone down. And there was also some gamesmanship going on with the $100 in present law, because people could donate and pool their resources, and so the value of a gift could be more than $100. So a $100 gift really does mean a $100 gift maximum. You couldn't get a gift that's $600 because 10 lawyers or 10 lobbyists got together and each chipped in $80 or so. That wouldn't happen under the OLC's recommendations. But the bigger change would be to increase the reporting requirements, to more frequent reporting. The thought is that if you have to itemize those things, some people may not accept them, some people may not be giving them. But another thing that I failed to mention at the beginning of my comments is that one of the initial decisions that the work group struggled with was Oregon has one of the broadest ethics laws in the country in terms of who it applies to. Oregon's applies to anyone who basically is associated in some assists at all state or local government. So we cover every elected person as well as volunteers, state employees, local employees. It covers a universe of folks. And so we're talking about small towns where a friendship may not be able to exist in a traditional sense of can't take somebody out to lunch because, golly, they're also on the city council and also help shovel snow with, you know, the parks or whatever it is. And so the work group made a conscious choice not to make exceptions for the type of public official, but to, as much as they could. There are a few exceptions still within the OLC's recommendations. But the group struggled with how to balance disclosure, just present practice, and trying to make things easier for people to understand, but applicable to everyone. And it wasn't an easy choice. Obviously, if you're making laws just for this assembly, you can change the standard a bit. But if you're trying to make rules that are applicable to everyone, and make sense to everyone, it's a little bit harder. So I hope that responds to your question, Representative.
So thank you. And Wendy, in that handout you were just referring us to, there parts of it are in italics and parts are just regular types. What does that italic part indicate?
Sure. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, this PowerPoint is a summary, if you will, of the entire ethics law chapter. And if we just gave you a list of what we changed, it wouldn't give you a good enough picture to get the context. And so we're providing you with a summary of Oregon law that's in regular print. And if it was changed at all, we put it in italicized font just to sort of tip you off, oh, this is something's different here. This quarterly report in and of itself is different. Obviously, present law, you have to report this information, but it's only once a year. So that's why quarterly is in italicized font.
So the italics indicate your recommendations that are changes to the current law then?
Correct. If I were to come back and give this to you in a true PowerPoint presentation on the computer, the italicized font is also in a different color. And if you go to the Law Commission's website, you'll see that it's generally in red or green font if it's a change to existing law.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on the reporting issue, is your recommendation to align the reporting by public officials as well as lobbyists?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, yes, the recommendation is quarterly reports for lobbyists on everything, and quarterly reports for public officials on this select group of things, in addition to their statement of economic interest. The statement of economic interest is modified a bit, especially on getting rid of those percentage things that people find complicated, and just listing the top five sources of income rather than trying to calculate which income, because it generally works out the same, but people have to do those calculations. But that static information, what we generally consider static, would only be once a year. But the quarterly report for these other things. The thought being that, especially if there's an appropriation made to make these reports online, it would make it easier for people to get their statements done on time. And it also, we did allow an amendment period of 30 days without penalty, so people could compare with others and make sure, yes, we've got it all right, and get it online so the public can search. Presently, all these reports are in file drawers in the Government Standards and Practices Commission's office, and it's difficult for you to check up on your own report. It's difficult for the press and the public to find these reports. Lobbyists can't check easily to see if they've given something to someone that it's reported, and vice versa. So having it online would help, but also more frequent. The work group felt would be a good step in the right direction. Obviously, our system isn't working particularly well now, but it's not clear. It wasn't clear to the work group that changing the limits really was the big problem, or if it was the process and the frequency. And so this was sort of a first step. Leaving the 10250 is pretty similar, but it also allows for people to give a bouquet of flowers, for example, in January when there's a wedding, but also a different type of thank you in March, whatever. It's hard to keep those limits, especially, as I said, it's applying to the whole universe of local officials and volunteers, that the 250 was kept, but without the entertainment.
Representative Brugger.
Yeah, I'd also like to comment, if you recall, when the Secretary of State was here and John Limbeck discussing the new OnStar and the new reporting system, we had a lot of discussion about how that would fit with this. And remember, I said to Mr. Limbeck, I wanted to see the train leave the station before we added any cars. This is the car that's a natural. But we've got to get one system going and proven, but then this would lend itself to an online reporting requirement where instead of trying to, as we did on our rules, sort of clamp down on the number to some sort of arbitrary thing of $10, say, which precludes the flowers, for instance, you would have a reporting system that's very transparent, where anybody could see this lobbyist gave this to this official or this. And remember, in the universe of local government, this gets complicated real fast. So it is sort of envisioned that into the future, these things might go together very nicely if we can get this online system of reporting going. And then in lieu of some really sort of difficult to maintain standard, we would have a more reasonable standard, which we've always had, $100 or $50 or whatever, but then there would be true transparency as to exactly what those gifts were and when they were given and who gave them to whom. And I think that would serve the public in a very real way.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, if that's all right.
Go ahead.
First, with the along the same lines of what Representative Brugger was discussing, is there anything in the proposed legislation that you'll be bringing forth that would preclude a city or a county from having even more stringent standards than what you're recommending? Would state law trump, in other words?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, no, that present law allows any government agency to have a stricter standard. The enforcement would be the difference. That a government entity would have to enforce anything stricter. It would be the GSPC providing enforcement.
Right. So that
would totally be permitted. And in fact, a good example is the cell phone issue, which was a big issue several years ago. Present law doesn't really provide an exception for that. If a local government body says, cell phone, we want you to have a cell phone, it's going to be part of your package, if you will, we need you to have a cell phone. Because it's not really salary, it's been a struggle.
Right.
So the Law Commission's recommendation is that financial gain is generally prohibited for public officials, one of the exceptions being your compensation package, and it will provide in the recommendation that compensation package can be determined by the local government body. So we don't have to put in statute cell phones are prohibited or cell phones are permitted, because frankly some agencies don't want frequent flyer miles, for example, to be given to their employees, but some local governments do. It depends on the compensation package that's given, and it's not a really one-size-fits-all problem. And so by saying compensation is packages, that's a permissible financial gain, and leaving it to the body to decide we felt like that was the best way to deal with the problem and not make it difficult for the Government Standards and Practices Commission to enforce, nor make it difficult to try to figure out a one-size-fits-all.
Great, thank you. Appreciate that answer. My other question is concerning campaign contributions. With Oregon being one of only five states without any limits on contributions, I'm wondering what the discussion was amongst the Law Commission and how the recommendation of continuing to permit unlimited campaign contributions might impact the public's perception of the political process being less than clean and fair.
Representative Rosenbaum, as Chair, and Vice Chair Buckley, if you look on the PowerPoint on page 8 and 9, which would be slides 15, 16, 17, and 18, provides you an overview of what the campaign contribution recommendations were. Campaign contributions were discussed by Attorney General Myers' work group at the get-go. It was the first issue to deal with. Campaign finance reform was not our charge in terms of looking at public finance or some other type of system. So we did not tackle that project, but we did look at the issue of use of campaign contributions because it's probably obvious, but if you're going to say you can't have a gift from a lobbyist that's over X dollars, but you allow a campaign contribution that's over that, and it can be used for basically the same thing as what if you would have bought the gift. So the lunch at Da Vinci's, I can't pay for that, or a gift certificate. I guess lunch doesn't work under present law, but a gift certificate to Da Vinci's, I couldn't give to you, but I could give you a campaign contribution of $100, and you can turn around and buy that same thing. That wasn't going to work, and so we had to deal with that question. So you will see on the recommendations, especially in slide 15, that the work group recommends limiting the use of campaign contributions to, no shocker here, support the nomination or election, or to purchase insurance, or to pay fines. But what you do not see there is present law, which allows campaign finance money to be used for expenses incurred in office. That is deleted from the chapter, 260, the Secretary of State rules. That's kind of an anomaly in Oregon. And from our discussions as a work group, we realized that this use of campaign monies for expenses once incurred in office is really only a legislative issue. The governor, for example, or a city council person who's running would never take leftover campaign money to pay their staff or buy pencils or whatever it was. It's sort of a legislative issue. And frankly, the work group felt that once you're in office, the public should be paying for your expenses and adequately provide staffing and adequately take care of your copy machine and everything else. We did recommend when deleting this use of campaign money for expenses incurred in office, a corollary change to your own budget. It's inadequate that you have strange little strange is chosen purposely, but I literally figured out every little pot of money you have, the various expense lines, and they're all pretty small when you put them all together, and they're complicated. Obviously the Public Commission and the legislature focused on that issue, but this would be a change in practice. It would present a hardship in some circumstances to your body, but it just didn't make sense of how it's being abused. We did do research on the amount of money that was used out of a campaign to what looked like expenses incurred in office, and they ranged from zero to hundreds of thousands of dollars in a year. The average was $3,000. So if you add approximately $3,000 to all 90, it's not a large expense, but it would allow us to delete that provision and make everyone on the same page and not have, basically if the gift rule is meaningless, if you still have the campaign rule the way it is presently. So it was a tug of war there.
Thank you.
And Wendy, you raise one concern, obviously, that I think we're going to hear as these proposals move forward, which is just the size of the current budgets for legislators.
Mm-hmm.
But I think another issue, and I'm not sure whether you considered this, is that there is also, and this isn't law, but it is in the legislature's own rules, a blackout period that takes place 60 days before every election. So basically that would be 120-day period out of every other year when legislators are prohibited from using legislative funds for all sorts of purposes, including, you know, ordinary communications that would be sort of a mass communication like a newsletter or even an electronic email that goes to more than just responding to an email that we receive. So did your proposal contemplate that blackout period, and how would that interface with what you're recommending?
Chair Rosenbaum, the Law Commission work group didn't look at how campaign finance rules are used, specifically, especially if they're not in statute, because your assembly has imposed those rules on itself. Obviously, if you can't use campaign money and you can't, and you don't have any enough money in your, and you, or, excuse me, if we prohibited campaign money in this proposal and your own rules don't allow you to use state funds, there's going to be a problem. Something's going to have to change. But we didn't address that specifically because it didn't really fit in the ethics topic.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously it wouldn't work. You couldn't do the public's work. I'm not sure what went into the thought process of your own rule of how why to make a blackout. I mean, obviously you don't want to be using public money for the election,
right.
But that's already prohibited by statute. So I guess it was just a cautionary rule or an abundance of caution to make sure you couldn't manipulate your correspondence, but I
wasn't here when it was adopted, but I think that the intent was to sort of put some limits on the advantages of being an incumbent during that period for 2 months before an election. So, but it has been now interpreted in a pretty broad way, so that there really are, I mean, there are whole aspects of doing a legislator's job that can't be funded through public funds right now at all. So,
I understand.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Yeah, I too, Chair Rosenbaum, have two questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
One would be relating to, particularly on page 7, slide 13, under general rule, it says public officials may receive gifts from any person except from a person who could reasonably be known to have a legislative or administrative interest in the government entity, blah, blah, blah. Okay. My question to you is, if I go out to lunch with a friend who actually may belong to AOI or the Realtors Association or what have you, I don't know about it necessarily, but they're a friend of mine, is it, should have been reasonable for me to know that they belong to these groups who have business before the legislature? I'm just wondering to what extent that particular definition extends.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, that's a difficult question. It's a reasonable standard from the public official's perspective, and so you look at that. But the lobbyist, if this friend was a lobbyist, they would also have that obligation. And so you know, you could be found for a violation. I don't think likely if you truly didn't know and you know, this person wasn't widely known to be a lobbyist, but the lobbyist would have that obligation as well.
Well, I guess follow-up to that question.
Go ahead.
If it's just a person who belongs to a group that has business before the legislature, does that count as somebody who is known to have business before the legislature just because they belong to a group who does?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, I don't think that that would be a conflict because you can be a member of a lot of things, but if you're not engaged in an advocacy or, I mean, that it's, there's also the class exception. You know, if all farmers would be benefited, for example, that's, they're not considered to have a legislative or administrative interest just because they might be benefited by some bill that's coming. You know, it's not, there's not enough nexus there.
Okay, thank you. And my second question,
go ahead.
Number 3, page 4, slide number 7, the third bullet down. It refers to, well, it says legislators may not receive money for lobbying for one session after they leave office. I wondered if during your discussions that there was any thought about making that not only prohibiting legislators from lobbying for private interests, but basically lobbying for government interests as government agency heads or whatever, because that can sometimes be perceived as the same type of situation, only for the government entity.
Great. Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, actually the way the bill should be coming out would apply to all legislators, whether they go into a private or public position, if they're required to register as a lobbyist. Obviously, the director issue had came up during our commission discussions. Chair Lane Jennerly is one of those directors, and he believes that that provision would have prohibited him from doing his job for at least a year. It doesn't say anywhere that he has to register as a lobbyist, but generally directors have to get their budgets through, and so they do have to register as lobbyists. He could have had a deputy, for example, do the lobbying part, and he would be able to take that appointment as director. But if you're going to lobby for public or private, the commission's recommendation is to put that revolving door ban for 1 year to make it as equal private and public.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hunt.
If I could also have two questions as well. Yeah, following up on your earlier discussion about prohibiting use of campaign funds for what would be considered legitimate kind of public legislative functions, I'm not seeing in here, in your recommendations, the corollary recommendation that you just said orally about recommending increased funding for to kind of offset the reduction in the use of campaign funds for legitimate legislative expenses. I'm not seeing the recommendation for the increase in public funding for that function.
Okay. Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, the PowerPoint presentation is a summary of the substantive laws that would be in statute. So we have another list of non-statutory recommendations. We don't put a budget line in statute, and so you won't see a lot of those types of things. We also have recommended lots of things to the agency of how it could improve its work, but they're not in statute. They're sort of their practice, and so those things are not listed here, but you will be getting a law commission report that explains the changes to statutory law, but also those that are non-statutory, and so it would be in that list.
Great. If I could follow up with the second question, Madam Chair, did you get into the whole issue of how per diem, and this may be, although this probably is not unique to legislators, there are probably local officials that deal with this as well, where public officials of whatever sort receive a per diem, and at least those who are elected may have campaign funds. I think both the GSPC and the Secretary of State have determined that under current law, it is legitimate to what I would consider double dip, where you receive a per diem in your pocket for expenses, and then you expend campaign money to pay those same expenses. Is that inherently dealt with in here, or talk about the intersection with per diem?
Sure. Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, that issue was directly addressed. That's actually probably where we started from, is
okay.
We had the problem of using campaign money to pay rent, insurance, and a whole bunch of other things,
right.
And then we had the double-dipping per diem mm-hmm. issue. By prohibiting campaign contributions to be used for expenses incurred once in office, you don't have to write a double-dipping rule or any other rule. It's campaign money can only be used for campaigning, period, and then you don't have that problem. And you wouldn't have there still may be the problem of double dipping during a campaign cycle if you're an incumbent, I suppose. But then the question is the given event a public event or, you know, public office event, or is it a campaign event? So it shouldn't be a real double dipping problem, but there still could be that question of where are you getting paid from, but it's only to be used for campaigning. But certainly it shouldn't be a session problem.
So I was curious, because in reading some of the current law, it looks like there are reporting thresholds that exist that don't correspond to dollar amounts anywhere else. There are all these places where it says lobbyists have to report if it's greater than $73. Did you actually go through these statutes and try to make sure that under your recommendations
we had thresholds that corresponded for what lobbyists report and then what legislators are required or bound by?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, that's a good question. Yes, there were all kinds of reporting thresholds, some that were static and some that were CPI adjusted, consumer price index adjusted, so you'd have to literally call up somebody or find on the computer each time to figure out, okay, where is the limit now? We considered keeping that consumer price index idea there. Just basically the advantage there is you don't have to come back to the legislature to deal with cost of living. But it's so complicated for folks to keep up with that the work group ultimately said, no, we're going to lower the threshold for when you have to report anyway, and we're not going to adjust it so that this body would have to go in and actually change the threshold. The thresholds are the same for both the giver and the receiver throughout our recommendations.
And a related question, I think that one of the things that does not work well right now is that the entities that are required to report don't necessarily know or understand those requirements. So did you address at all how people should get notified or trained on what the new law would say?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, there's a couple of pieces to that question. One is we recognize that the ethics agency, the Government Standards and Practices Commission, has not been adequately funded for a long time, and therefore the amount of training that it does is pretty limited. It doesn't have user-friendly websites. It doesn't have manuals for different entities that have specific issues. There is no entity manual, for example. There is no nice, handy manual for all of our school teachers that this applies to that would help them with their specific issues. There's no specific manual for legislators. There's a general manual, and there is training available if you call up the Government Standards and Practices Commission and ask for a training. Obviously, if they had a flood of calls, they wouldn't be able to address them all. But we learned by going to some commission meetings that a number of folks, I would say a great deal of folks in the state, don't even know that these laws exist or that they apply to them. So on the specific issue of entities not knowing, obviously there needs to be more education. Handouts and such would be helpful, but the reporting requirements are recommended to be changed by the Law Commission's work so that the entity and lobbyists who work for that entity, if they're contract lobbyists or if they're in-house, are the same. It's interesting that under present law, a lobbyist has to report twice a year on an even year and three times a year on an odd year, but the entity is only once a year all the time. Right. So there's this strange disadvantage, if you don't want public disclosure, if you will, to always reimburse your lobbyist, so it's never being published only once a year. And so that just didn't seem to be fair or make a lot of sense. And so the Law Commission work group recommended it should be the same for everybody. It shouldn't matter if it's an entity report or if a lobbyist report or the public official. They all should be on the same schedule and they all should be on the same thresholds for identified items.
Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, if I could further respond on this training issue, one of the things that we discussed was the funding level of the GSPC, and it was very clear to me in working on this, we have a huge training issue. And the GSPC is seen by a lot of us and a lot of folks in the public as some sort of punishing body that comes in when something wrong happens. And we need to change that dynamic considerably and see it as a resource for local government, which is just a universe beyond us that has a huge issue here, and all the volunteers and teachers in classrooms who they're busy teaching. They don't know this whole book of laws applies to them, and they get caught up in it. Funding a training component within GSBC was something really high on my priority to talk about this session. So just to let you know, that's high on my hit parade because people have to know before they can. And by cleaning up these laws and then telling people what their obligations are, I think we'll solve a lot of problems.
And just so committee members will know, we are going to be hearing from the GSPC at our next hearing on Friday, so I think some of these questions you can also clarify with them. Representative Esquivel.
I think Representative Berger brings up some very good points there. We had a council member when I was on the city council in Medford that had a laptop. He took it home, was using it for city business, and didn't think about it and sent an email. on a personal basis. Well, it ended up, when it came back to the city, it picked up on this email, and he was fined $150 or what it was. But he didn't know what he didn't even know about the situation. And I think education is a very vital part of this, because maybe throughout everyone's career, whether it's a local situation where it's a small town, you really don't know when you're doing something wrong that may seem very innocent. To him, it was very innocent. Well, I just emailed so-and-so to talk about that such and such. Well, it was still illegal. So I think that's a very good point, Representative Berger.
Any further questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say hi to Mr. Sears and say, you know, appreciate you being here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Might you have anything that you'd like to add?
No, I think I should say for the record, Sam Sears, the Oregon Law Commission. Thank you so much for having both of us here. It's a pleasure for us to explain this process. We've been working very hard and very diligently on this, and I think Wendy has adequately addressed these questions and covered the material, and I'm just happy to be here to assist in any way.
And one final question the staff has actually suggested, which I think is a good one. There does seem to be some overlap in your recommendations and those that are coming forward from the Public Commission on the Legislature. Did you interact with them at all or consider what they were recommending, and how do we see those as coordinating?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I think there are, from my account, there are really only two big issues that overlapped, the area of campaign finance contribution use and the area of nepotism. My understanding is the Public Commission and the Legislature relied on the Law Commission's work on campaign finance, and they're basically duplicative of our work. You know, which one survives is obviously your choice, but they're consistent, and the Legislative Council work and everybody else work to be able to take some of that same research and yes. It's just a second endorsement of the same thing. In the area of nepotism, I also believe it's pretty similar. I think both Commission struggled with the exception that is permitted for legislators to hire relatives or to supervise and hire relatives. It's an interesting problem because present law wouldn't permit it. It, to my knowledge, has never been prosecuted, but you will not find an exception for legislators to hire relatives. There's no exception. There's a financial gain prohibition in present law, and there aren't any exceptions. So the Law Commission's work group took the step of actually codifying that exception so that it's not just a practice that you can go to a rule and see it. But in codifying a nepotism rule for the whole state, instead of relying on a general, you can't have financial gain for yourself or your relatives, that's in present law, we actually spelled it out for employment, because that's confusing to people, because they'll read it and they'll go, oh, well, I'm not being hired because I'm, you know, a relative of the city council person. I'm being hired because I've got this degree and I have this experience. And so it's difficult for people to read the statute. And so we have a specific recommendation of how to handle nepotism. It wouldn't prohibit, I'll just kind of briefly, it's on one of your slides, but briefly, it does allow a relative to work for the same public body, but it doesn't allow for the person who does the interviews or the hiring decisions to be the relative. So it's got to be separated from that process. And it also generally doesn't allow supervision of a relative unless the public body makes that decision, has a policy. That was sort of a compromise that it's generally it's permitted for private entities to prohibit supervision and prohibit hiring, but it's not required either, and so we're allowing an entity to make that decision, but the entity needs to make that decision. It shouldn't be the public official gets to hire the relative and the body itself isn't aware of the problem or whatever, so that's how we dealt with it. So it's a specific provisions rather than leaving it to the broad no financial gain.
Okay. Well, it looks like you've answered all our questions for this morning, and I know we'll be seeing lots more of you as the bills come forward. So thanks very much for being with us, and thank you for all of the great work. And if there's nothing further to come before us, we are adjourned.